This is Alaska Public Media's Community in Unity, a public forum recorded in the KAKM studios on December 3rd.
Welcome to Community in Unity, a community conversation about successful prisoner reentry. I'm Ann Hillman, the Urban Affairs Reporter for Alaska Public Media. About 1,000 people re-enter the community every month leaving prison. We interact with them every single day. We just don't necessarily know it. People coming back into the community face unique challenges and barriers. About 63% of them will end up going back. But there's ways to reduce that number. Today, we're talking about successful prisoner reentry. We have a panel of guests today. We have Carmen Gutierrez, who is the former deputy commissioner of the Department of Corrections. She's also the architect of the Recidivism Reduction Plan. Morgan Jaco is the reentry coordinator for the Department of Corrections. Chet Adkins is a returning citizen, a former inmate, and he's currently also a mentor to people who are reentering the community. And we have Kathleen McLaughlin, who is the director of the Partners Reentry Center. Also in the studio, unlike other days, we have a live studio audience, which means we'll be taking questions from people who have knowledge about the subject or just interest. So we welcome as many questions as possible, and thank you for being here. Before we get started and jump into the conversation, Carmen, I'd love for you to give a little bit of background.
Thank you very much, and I really appreciate the opportunity to participate in this important event. I think when community members think about prisoner reentry, one of the questions that may come to mind is, well, why should we be concerned about that? I mean, those folks are people who have violated the law, and they're going to pay the consequence for having done so. So what is it to us? And I think successful prisoner reentry is a very, very important issue to all of Alaskans, and it is really one that I would encourage to have on the forefront of all of our minds.
Yes.
As Ann was stating earlier, DOC is releasing approximately 1,000 prisoners into Alaska's communities every month, and these are people who have either been convicted of a misdemeanor or a felony offense. And the question really is, to what extent are our communities prepared to receive these individuals back into the community so that they can have what we talk about as a second chance for them to become successful and productive members of our communities? And that question really depends upon to what extent are our communities prepared to have housing available for these folks, to what extent are our communities prepared to employ these individuals, and to what extent do our nonprofits and the state have ongoing mental health and substance abuse support systems. Many of you may not know, but DOC is the state's largest mental health provider in the state of Alaska. And 65% of the people who are in custody are people who have a diagnosed mental illness or severe substance abuse problem. So, Ann also stated that although we have this many people coming back into our community, 63% of these individuals return to prison within the first 3 years of their release. Most of these individuals come back within the first 6 months. So if we look at the cost, you know, what it costs for the court system, what it costs for law enforcement, what it costs for the public defenders and the prosecuting attorneys, and what it costs the Department of Corrections, I would submit to you that Alaskans are not receiving good value for the criminal justice dollars spent when two out of three people go back to prison. The cost to incarcerate someone is probably much higher than many people realize. Today, it costs $142 per day per inmate to incarcerate a person in corrections. That is essentially, that is $52,000 per year per inmate. And I, out of curiosity today, looked up online what it costs for 1 year of tuition at Harvard. And that is $58,000. So But unfortunately, in our case, in Alaska, 2 out of 3 people are failing in our communities and going back to prison. So we need to also look at who we incarcerate today. And our statistics show that in Alaska, we're incarcerating more people that we're mad at than the people that we're afraid of. And the reason I say that is because today, 40% of the inmate population are people who are awaiting trial. They haven't even been convicted and sentenced. And the social research shows that incarcerating people, low-risk individuals with higher-risk individuals, leads to very poor outcomes. You know, jails are reputed to be educational centers for criminality, and there's actually a tremendous amount of research today that supports that. Additionally, today, DOC incarcerates far more people that are nonviolent than violent offenders. In 2002, the vast majority of our inmate population were violent offenders. Today, that's completely turned on its head, and the vast majority of our prison population are nonviolent offenders. So the good news is the state has really learned a lot about how to change the way we do business. And the other people on the panel tonight are going to be talking about new evidence-based approaches that we hope will provide Alaskans with much better return on the criminal justice dollars spent.
So let's jump straight into that conversation. A lot of the process of re-entering the community begins when you're still on the inside. So Morgan, I would love it if you could talk a bit about what the programs are and what Department of Corrections is doing to prepare people for re-entering the community.
Well, currently, you know, each facility has different programs available, but the concentration is on rehabilitative programs and looking at their individual needs. So we have substance abuse programming, educational programs, vocational training, substance abuse, and, you know, of MRT programs and just different things.
And what is MRT?
Moral recognition therapy. So behavioral programs that really focus on somebody's individual needs and really helping them so they can be successful once they get out.
And then do you also work with people in developing plans for reentry?
Yes, that's a very important piece of it. It's really vital to have a plan once you do get released so you can follow that and make sure all your ducks are in a row before the release. So the institutional probation officers work with that individual, along with, you know, the education coordinators and everybody coming together as a team to help them out. We have a 3-phase process that really looks at that, and we develop an OMP, which is an offender management plan, to focus on a roadmap that everybody can be part of, including the individual themselves, because that's really important that they have a say.
All right. And so, Chet, you were recently one of those individuals. You were in prison for 28 years, you said. Can you talk about what tools you were given to prepare for release?
Like I said, I did 2 days short of 28 years, counting my halfway house time. And in that time, I was given very limited tools. I was spent 18 years out of state, separated from my family, separated from my community, separated from my culture. The vocational opportunities are limited. Which is just one component of what you need to be successful. It's been my experience that the most of the programs I've seen and participated in were 90% show and 10% substance. They really didn't, they were there to say that we're doing this, not to show that we're going to rehabilitate anybody, we're not going to help somebody succeed when they get out. When I got short, I asked for help repeatedly.
What do you mean when you got short?
When I got within 2 years,
okay.
I asked for help repeatedly. I was told that we don't do, we don't do this till you're like 90 days short. Okay.
Oh, and just out of context, so how long ago was that?
That was 2 years ago. I was released from the halfway house in March of this year. I got back to Alaska in May of 2013.
Okay.
During that whole period, I asked repeatedly for help learning how to operate computers, basic Word, Microsoft Word systems.
So that you would have the skills?
Yeah, very little help there. It wasn't until the last few months when I got to Palmer Minimum that I got some help there. The one thing that I did get when I was in Colorado, I went through an RSAT program, Residential Substance Abuse Treatment.
Oh, okay.
And that was very effective. That had a lot to do with relieving me, helping me shed the last of my convict and criminal thinking. And that was because of the people running the program. When I came back up to Alaska, I was still part of the RSAT program, and when we got here, I thought the focus shifted away from helping people help themselves to running people through a program so they can bill for it. That's just my opinion. That was 2 years ago. I'm hoping this changed, but you know, I have my doubts.
Morgan, do you feel like things are starting to change?
I do, and I hope that they continue to progress and go down the path that we're going. You know, I'd hope that your experience is not one that everybody has. We were sending people out of state, and that's the exact issue with that, is you do lose the connection with family and those skills. And you know, the reunification process is so important that, you know, we are back. We don't have any prisoners out of state at this point. That's a huge move. That's a good shift in the right direction. And we're focusing on continuing to improve the experiences so someone else in your situation doesn't happen again.
And Carmen, would you like to add to this?
The Department of Corrections in about 2006 essentially eliminated all rehabilitative programs due to the philosophy at the time that nothing works. That philosophy, fortunately, has been completely refuted. So programming started to be re-implemented in the institutions basically during the first part of the Sean Parnell administration. And so this is an ongoing process, and it's one that requires legislative support. And the good news is the Department of Corrections has received a lot of legislative support for these kinds of programs. But if we do not learn how to do our business more effectively and really focus on the rehabilitative approaches that work, we could find ourselves once again in a situation where we need to start incarcerating individuals out of state again. And that is something that nobody wants to do.
So the focus in DOC is shifting to make sure there's more rehabilitative programs. I'd also like to invite to the conversation Venus Woods, who is the director of the Adult Reentry Program for the Alaska Native Justice Center. And you are also a former inmate yourself. I was wondering, can you talk about your experiences when you were incarcerated? Did you feel like there was a move to help you rehabilitate? And then also your experiences now as you're going back in helping others.
Absolutely. Well, I did most of my time at Lemon Creek Correctional Center, which is mostly for pre-release for women. And so when I did get, I was only at Highland Mountain for 3 months, but when I got there, TLC, which is Transformational Living Community, it's a faith-based treatment program. It was just starting. I was in the first ever class of it. So my experience with DOC was very positive. They did help me. It helped me tremendously. And I also was able to get released to electronic monitoring. For me, it gave me a really good foundation of I stayed with my sister and her husband, and I was on electronic monitoring for 14 and a half months. And it gave me a really good foundation of what a normal family feels like. And I think I really needed that. I also needed that time away from my children so that I could get myself into order and do treatment. And I got involved in a reentry program at the Alaska Native Justice Center. And just, you know, I just really needed to work on myself before I could reconnect with them.
You're listening to Community in Unity, a public forum recorded at Alaska Public Media on December 3rd on successful prisoner reentry. I'm your host, Anne Hillman. We're hearing from Venus Woods from the Alaska Native Justice Center, Morgan Jaco from the Department of Corrections, Carmen Gutierrez, who wrote part of the state's recidivism reduction plan, Chet Adkins, a returning citizen, and Kathleen McLaughlin from the Partners Reentry Center.
Department of Corrections data shows that recidivism rates for people who receive substance abuse treatment are about 20 to 30% lower than for the people who do not. So if you receive treatment, you're less likely to recidivate. And it's also often a condition of parole. Venus, you mentioned TLC, the Transformational Living Communities, and a lot of people I've talked to have been through that program. Is that the only substance abuse treatment program available from within the correctional system? And Morgan, also feel free to jump in, please.
I don't know if it's, I'm not sure if it's counted as substance abuse treatment, even though we do touch on those issues there. But I know that there's RSAT, LSAT, OSAT, there's...
What are those?
We have intensive outpatient treatment and residential treatment within the facilities. Aftercare programs are components of it. And then, like Venus was talking about, she was the TLC program. There's a various different things that are faith-based. Mm-hmm. And so you can choose to go into what interests you and what really is going to help you, since everybody has different needs. But there are various programs and different treatment opportunities, as well as at the halfway houses, the community residential centers. When they get out, they can continue that on the outside and start building their support groups. And, you know, there's AA and there's different various treatment components inside.
And is it mandatory for people who have substance-related offenses?
It depends on the individual's probation or parole conditions. Mm-hmm. And when we're when the institution probation officer is doing the assessment upon intake, they're really looking at what their needs are. So if there is some sort of substance abuse issue, they are going to refer them to that program.
Can people be required to do treatment when they're on the inside?
At different times, depending upon their offense and, you know, the variables surrounding it.
Okay. Yeah. And are there plans within DOC to increase the availability of treatment on the inside of prisons, or?
That's everybody's hope. It goes down to funding. Okay. But yes, since it has been shown to reduce recidivism and make everyone, you know, our communities healthier, mm-hmm. I think that's definitely a goal of the department.
And Kathleen, you're with the Partners Reentry Program. How much do you work with connecting people to treatment options?
We do quite a bit. We take people who would otherwise be homeless when they release. And if people don't know, you release from the Anchorage Jail parking lot. That's where you start your reentry in Anchorage. And so we will take people that are otherwise gonna otherwise be homeless, and we house, employ, try to get employment for them, and also deal with the behavioral aspect. With respect to that behavioral aspect, we do straight referrals to substance abuse assessors. We just currently partnered with Cook Inlet Tribal Council, who actually physically brings a substance abuse assessor into our facility to do assessments there. Because one of the fallacies of, and one of the challenges of our system is that if you're homeless and you are mandated to do substance abuse and get a job and do all the other things to unify with your family, if you're otherwise homeless, you're not going to get to those other steps mm-hmm. until you figure out where the housing is and where you have a safe place to transition in. And so what we find, which is a real problem in our community, but it's a challenge, it's really not a problem because everything can be fixed, is the wait times to get into a substance abuse treatment program are long. Mm-hmm. And that wait list, if you already have a hankering to drink or to use, you're not gonna say, you know, I think I'm gonna do it, I'm gonna hang on for 2 months before I start a substance abuse treatment. Mm-hmm. So yes, we do direct referrals, but the handoffs are kind of clunky right now because we can't get people in a timely fashion.
Which is a problem for a lot of different partners in the community for a lot of issues. Mm-hmm. Beyond just substance abuse treatment, a lot of conversation I've heard when we're learning about this topic is having to change how you think about things. And Chet, I'd really like to bounce back to you for this one, because I remember when you were telling me your personal story, you talked a lot about how growing up, you felt like you were so exposed to criminal thinking that you didn't know how else to process things. Can you talk about that a bit, and then talk about how you learned to view the world differently?
Well, as a teenager, I was raised in a criminal environment, but it's not so much how I learned to view the world differently. I went back to an earlier time. I spent my first 5 years in the village with my grandparents. And I can't explain how or why, but at some point around 12 or 14 years, I began to accept responsibility for the things that I'd done.
12 or 14 years into prison.
In prison. And mm-hmm. and I wish I could tell you why or how so it could be used, but it just started happening. And that was how that was a process that took me about probably 7 or 8 years before I was finally able to turn my head around and start thinking rationally rather than criminally.
Can you talk about sort of what a different thought pattern would be?
Well, it comes right down to just accepting responsibility for the things you've done and being able to empathize with other people. I mean, one of the hardest things for me to admit is that for most of my life, my idea of guilt was feeling sorry for myself for getting caught. So rather than that, I actually can empathize with somebody that's been a victim of crime. Now I can see the pain, I can feel the pain. And that's the difference. And I don't know how you can teach that other than, you know, give people a taste of it. One of the biggest things that helped me with that is there was a victim's impact program in Arizona where they brought the parents of murdered children in, and they told their stories, and it was raw. And you couldn't deny the consequences of the things that happened. And that was one of the stepping stones that I had.
All right. Venus, you do teach people MRT, which was mentioned earlier. Can you talk about exactly what that is, moral recognition therapy, how it works, how you teach it?
Yeah. So MRT, moral recognition therapy, is a evidence-based practice. It can be a 12 to 16 step. Most classes are taught with 12 steps. You do one step a week, and basically what it's trying to do is it's trying to teach you how to think differently. I like it because it's based on the individual. A lot of times people, when they get out, they go to substance abuse groups or they go to support groups, but MRT is just about them. It starts with being honest. It touches on a lot of different topics. It also, they have to do community service with it, and not typical community service. It's very specific to what they have to do. But I really think that everyone could benefit from MRT.
So when we discussed it once, you described it's like you're learning how to be part of a community and how to give back to a community.
Right.
Why is that something essential to teach?
Well, I think that a lot of people that end up in institutions and people that come from families like mine, we don't know how to be part of a community. You don't understand what the benefits are of being a part of a community. And I think that that's a huge thing for people that are getting out of prison. Also, to give back, but also to learn how to be part of a community.
And does that also mean learning or relearning social skills? Like if you've been in prison for a good number of years, Chet, was it hard for you to know, like, proper ways to talk to people, how to interact in a large group?
Not was, is. I spent 6 months in a halfway house. I've been out of the halfway house about 7 months. I still find myself in situations where I don't know what to do. You know, prison is based around conflict and hierarchy and all those things, and those things don't work in the real world. And I have to question myself all the time before I act, before I open my mouth. I have to use a filter. Here too.
Kathleen, when you're working with people who are reentering the community, do you find that this is a common issue, and how do you help guide them?
Oh, absolutely. You know, soft skills are something that you practice on a daily basis if you're out in the community. If you've been incarcerated, especially if it's over 10 years, some of those soft skills you just simply don't know because they're not ones that you are having to use when you're inside. One of the challenges is a lot of people are coming out, they haven't seen a computer, they haven't seen a cell phone, they don't know how to negotiate streets. We have a lot of Alaska Natives who have to come to Anchorage to do their post-release treatment. They are not urban skilled. They're great in their villages, but they're not urban skilled. So what we face, because we take the people that have high LSIR scores, which means high risk, high needs, and we take them who would otherwise be homeless. So this is the highest level of people that will most likely recidivate. And so when you're looking at them, you have to decide, how can we partner with them to teach them how to mold themselves and reunite into a community? And a lot of it is as simple as how to understand to navigate a bus. How to get to the Social Security office, because why do you need a Social Security card? How to get a state ID? How to message well? No offense, Chet, because you haven't done this, but a lot of people who come out, they talk like really super loud. Not because they are trying to be abrasive, it's that's how they communicated for so many years, that they don't know a different level, like an inside voice. So,
and I've got that problem all the time. Members, so.
but I think that the real key is that there are those kinds of things that just through practice, when people release, will they kind of get the sense that they can unify and reunite into the community and blend in.
One of the tools that's put forth to try to help people transition back in are the halfway houses, also known as community residential centers. And DOC contracts out to the private companies to run them. Chet, you brought up a couple of times that you were released to a halfway house. Would you like to talk a little bit about what that was like?
That's the hardest time I've ever done. I felt like it was a setup for failure. The rules were unclear. I felt that you weren't given real opportunities. You were given more obstacles than opportunities.
Can you give an example?
Okay, there's a one of the people that work there is called a terminator. His function is to go out and catch you out of bounds. And out of bounds can be simply as much as turning down the wrong street on your way back to the halfway house. I was placed on lockdown for being back 20 minutes late. Mm-hmm. The things and if you've got a job and you're placed on lockdown, you can't go to your job until the issue's resolved, and that takes 3 to 5 days at least.
So you felt like some of the rules were not quite rational or helpful.
And they have absolute power, and then they hold it over you, because if you step out of line, you challenge them, and you tell them what they're doing is wrong, they send you back to jail.
As you mentioned, our halfway houses, the state's halfway houses, are under contract with a vendor, and the contract is managed by the Alaska Department of Corrections. But the vendor, in most cases in Alaska, is a private prison operator. And their motives and incentives may be very different than a state prison system because of it's privatized. And so I think that it's really important for Alaskans to look at how private prison operators run their systems as compared to how the state runs its system. And we heard Mr. Atkins talk about the quality of programming that he received when he was out of state doing his time. And Mr. Atkins was doing his time at a private operated prison. And again, DOC is overseeing these contracts, but the quality of the programming being provided by the private operator is much harder for the Department of Corrections to control and supervise than it is when it's running its own programs.
And Morgan, I was talking to the Deputy Commissioner, Diane Casto, about this issue, mm-hmm. and she said that she recognizes that there's problems, mm-hmm. and that you guys are trying to come up with solutions to fix them. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I mean, as Carmen had stated, we oversee those contracts. So we are working with the private vendors to have better case management, more programming, more effective programming, staff members that are more invested with that job, wanting to be there. I've heard a lot of people's experiences as an actual a positive one. So I think there's just, some people's experiences are different than others. Mm-hmm. I will say that, we're trying to work on becoming on the halfway houses, becoming more effective tools for rehabilitation. And I think we're down that path. One thing that we have to keep in mind, though, is that some of the individuals at the halfway houses are currently still serving a sentence. So we do have to, public safety is number one for the Department of Corrections. We have to keep that in mind. So there's a balance that's really important. And that's just key at points.
And I've heard that over and over, talking to different parole officers and different people within the department, that it is a balance of rehabilitation and keeping the community safe.
You're listening to Community in Unity, a public forum on successful prisoner reentry recorded at Alaska Public Media. I'm Ann Hillman. One element of the forum was an art show that aims to reduce the stigma of having a criminal history. The portraits in the show highlight the community's diversity and show that it's impossible to tell who has a criminal history and who doesn't just by looking at them. This feature is about Grace Harrington, who developed the show.
Well, I like to take photos. I started taking photos with my iPhone. This photo project I've had in my mind for a long time is one where I want to take portraits of human beings and a diverse range of just people. And I want some of them to have a background, and I want some of them not to have a background. And I want people to not be able to tell the difference, because that's actually what life is, that you don't know who someone is. People have a notion that they understand who other people are. So that's human nature too, is to take inventory of who's standing in front of you and kind of, based on your own understanding, you know, make your mind up about them. And when I drop the F-bomb and say I'm a felon, a lot of people are absolutely flabbergasted. When I was 18, I got my first felony, and it's actually been my only felony. But it impacted me so hard that, you know, I went to rehab out of state. Even though I had a strong support system, it still just, it tore through my life, and I realized what I didn't want to be. I wanted the chance to take photos of everyday people to kind of emulate the experience that I have when I introduce myself, and then when I finally talk about my background, how it's kind of, it shatters the idea of how people view somebody with a background. And so I wanted to give that opportunity to more than just one person. And one of the most beautiful things is somebody that's broken. And there's just a rawness, and it's gorgeous to be able to work with somebody, because I've been there. And I know just how powerful that can be, even if it's just a couple people that have a perspective change. I'll be happy.
That was Grace Harrington talking about reducing the stigma of having a criminal history through her portrait series, Community in Unity, Showing All Faces. You're listening to a public conversation about successful prisoner reentry.
And we have a question now from an audience member for our panel. Please welcome.
Hi, so I am a family member of a current inmate, and one of the things that I have encountered personally is incredible barriers and stigma working with the facility as a family member. And I know that the Department of Corrections states that its mission and vision is eventual reintegration into the community, but one of the things that a lot of the current policies do is they strategically cut off an individual from their family members, from their support structures, from the people who love them while they're inside. And in some examples of that, Department of Corrections has a policy that seems somewhat arbitrary that limits an inmate to 10 individuals that are allowed to see them on their visitors list permanently. So if you have a large family, if you have more than 10 people that want to see you, we literally have to trade off and say, okay, I won't get to see him for a year. And I'll trade out so that my wife can. You know, some of the other issues that we've run into is just trying to advocate for that inmate when something was going on, when there was a problem with the facility or a problem with, you know, anything that was going on with them. Just met a lot of hostility, a lot of outright hostility from some of the staff, while other staff are very open arms, very bend over backwards to try and assist you. So I guess I have that question for the group as far as how you feel that affects the system, and whether there's any movement on trying to change that area, because realistically, somebody already mentioned 40% of our inmates are pre-trial, My family went through 7 years of a pretrial process before we even got to the point that we are now. And as it is right now, we're looking at a 3-year waiting period for appeal before an appeal can even be reviewed because the state is so backed up. So you're looking at a decade of a family member, you know, waiting for a resolution for their loved one, and hoping not to get cut off. So that's my, my question is whether there's going to be any change there.
And
I mean, I cannot speak to that specifically. I know that we are looking at all of the policies that are possible barriers to reentry and for reunification. And that is, it's the ultimate goal for the department. I'm not aware of all of the policies that strategically are placed there. I know that, as she had stated, there are people that will bend over backwards, and there are others that, you know, aren't as open and willing and wanting to help. And that's part of this, you know, shift in attitude that the department is working on, and it's a focus. So it's one aspect of reentry that is an important one, and, you know, that's part of the reason why we're not, hopefully, not sending anyone back out of state, because we do see that family is very important.
And Kathleen?
You know, I just wanted to interject that the Partners Reentry Center has been around for a little over 2 years. And during this period of time, we have seen a shift. And the shift has been, instead of Anchorage POs saying the old thing, trail them, nail them, and jail them, what they're saying is, let's case manage and let's find a way for someone to stay out. So there is a shift with respect to post-release. One of the things that I think is beautiful about this forum also is these are issues we need to, as a community, address with the Department of Corrections. It's not a bad thing or a good thing. It's we have to be open and honest and forthright about it. But from my vantage point, we have seen a shift in the willingness for the POs, the institutional POs, and the Department of Corrections to work with us.
So what I hear you saying is that, yes, this is a very genuine problem that you have with your family. And there's an institutional shift to try to limit these problems. And Carmen.
And there's also the monetary issue. I mean, right now, the Department of Corrections budget is $333 million. 79% of that operating budget goes to personnel services, to the people that run the system. And there is always a pressure on the system to utilize personnel in the most efficient manner possible. And so sometimes policies and procedures are put into place because, for example, limiting the number of family members who can come and visit an inmate because there's pressures on personnel costs in terms of, you know, there's always a staffing issue. And so, you know, these budgetary realities can sometimes get in the way of what it is the department would ideally do if it didn't have the same budgetary pressures.
Okay. I'd like to invite another community question. Thank you.
Hi, good evening. I'd like to thank you all. My name is Brett Pierce. I'm a Tsimshian artist from Ketchikan, Alaska, and I've worked with Kathleen for 2 years now. And my question is, it has to do with the last 20 years, I've seen different commissioners through the state of Alaska for Department of Corrections work with different budgets. And it has to do with Governor Walker getting the toughest budget that he's ever given as Parnell handing him down with the declining oil prices and stuff happening that is going to give a tougher means for the operating costs for Department of Corrections. So in the years I've seen, in the years of different commissioners, and I can go back to different commissioners when the owner, the Captain Cook, was a commissioner back then, and he was from Sitka, Lloyd Hames.
Yes.
And so I follow it. So I got to commend you for a job that you're doing with the Department of Corrections for the programming that you have with the costs and stuff that you both are giving to the inmates, because I'm seeing that as an inmate that's coming out into society, it's very difficult for a person to regenerate back into society, to get a job, to find transportation, to find housing, to have all that. And now it's come to a time that it's finally, in the different years that I've seen, this is the first year I've really seen it. Anchorage, or as a community, come whole to find a solution to our problems that have been going for many years and many years. And so I just want to commend DOC and everybody that's on this panel. This is great, a great forum. And it needs to be worked like this, because it'll work out a lot of problems and a lot of difficulties for families that have to have inmates that are incarcerated. Because as a family member, if an inmate's incarcerated, they're also doing jail time as a family member with the inmates, because they're having to deal with all the problems as that inmate, because that's how society has it. So I just want to commend everybody, and I hope that the budget won't be cut too tremendously, because that is going to stop a lot of your hard work that you guys have been working for. So thank you.
Thank you very much for reintroducing us straight into another topic I'd really like to get into. One of the shifts that we've seen, and one of the things he was speaking about, is that it's a community effort. This isn't just a DOC problem. This isn't a partners reentry problem. It's an everybody issue. And now the state has new reentry coalitions. Morgan, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about those.
Sure. It's exciting times. I was just thinking that as Brett was talking, that he's really pointing out a really important piece that we're going down, which is collaborative work. Mm-hmm. We're making sure that everybody is working together, because the department recognizes that we can't do this alone. We don't want to do this alone. It's an issue that affects everyone. And, you know, as he stated, the family members are also serving time, and it affects our entire community. And so we have, currently the Mental Health Trust Authority has funded four coalitions, one in Anchorage, Mat-Su, Fairbanks, and Juneau. We have four, hopefully, up and coming, Kenai, Dillingham, Nome, and Bethel. And we're really just focusing, the coalitions are made up of different service providers and key stakeholders within the community. And really, at this point, we're doing a community assessment, making sure that we can look at all of the assets that we have so we can identify the barriers and limitations, and then just plan a really comprehensive reentry plan that includes the coalitions and all of the people in them. And then we're planning on doing inReach, and having that. That's a really important key, is making sure that there's the connection between the community and the institutions for the reentrant when they are releasing.
And Venus, you're involved in the inReach. Can you talk a little bit about what you're doing as a community partner inside the prisons and inside the halfway houses?
Yeah, we at the Alaska Native Justice Center, we go out to the prisons, different prisons, monthly, and we meet with any individual that's getting out within the next 6 months that will be releasing to Anchorage. We just talk with them a little bit about our program, but we also talk about the other reentry programs in Anchorage, because we want to make sure that they get all the services that they need. And then we also will meet with them one-on-one if they're getting released like that month, because we want to make sure that they have a plan. We also go to the halfway houses and we do support groups. Our target population there is mostly the confined misdemeanants, because they don't get a lot of services there. So we do just a support group, different topics, healthy relationships, budgeting, mock interviewing, stuff like that.
Basic life skills that some of us all need help with.
Yeah.
You're listening to Community in Unity, a public forum on successful prisoner reentry. I'm your host, Anne Hillman. Community members are asking a panel of guests about issues with the criminal justice system and successful reentry. The panelists are Venus Woods from the Alaska Native Justice Center, Morgan Jaco from the Department of Corrections, Carmen Gutierrez, who wrote part of the state's recidivism reduction plan, Chet Adkins, a returning citizen, and Kathleen McLaughlin from the Partners Reentry Center.
I'd like to invite another community member to ask a question, please.
Hi, I'm Jason Pirtle, member of the Anchorage community. Thank you for your time. Last year, a publication called the Prison Legal News released an article which detailed the reduction in the prison population in Sweden. A couple interesting things that I found in that article.
were statistics, one of which Sweden has a prison population of just under 5,000, which is comparable to the state of Alaska. Maybe most remarkable was that there were 4,500 volunteers from the community who participated in prison programs which were meant to help reduce recidivism. And, you know, I served over 10 years in Alaska Correctional Centers, and from that experience, I remember the positive impact that volunteers had, people that came in and donated their time and effort to, you know, reach out a helping hand. These people were passionate about what they did and interested in building a relationship with individuals. With that in mind, do you think that it would be worthwhile to research the Swedish model and possibly apply some of those methods to the state of Alaska?
And I invite any of you. I mean, is it possible to volunteer in the correctional system? I mean, thank you for providing a solution that community members can do in general.
You know, that's kind of the idea about the coalitions, making sure that we get you and anybody that wants to be involved, anybody with that passion, come join. You know, the next Anchorage Coalition meeting is next Wednesday. NeighborWorks, come there. I can give you guys more information. But, you know, community members, volunteers, that is a really important piece to the puzzle. And so anything, you know, I haven't actually read anything about that Swedish model. It sounds really interesting. I think the department is wanting to look at anything that could possibly help reduce recidivism. That's everybody's goal.
And I think that's really key, is that this is a community issue. It's a, mm-hmm. it's a public safety issue. And the key for, I think, all of us is to find a way to volunteer. At the Partners Reentry Center, we get a lot of calls on how can we volunteer, because a lot of people don't know how to. But the more that we collaborate with the Department of Corrections and Anchorage Alaska Native Justice Center and New Life Development, there are ways to do that. In the faith-based area, Jim Duncan was telling me that there was like over 100 volunteers that were focusing on particularly Goose Creek, and because they were coming out of Matsu Valley. So I think you're absolutely right that it is a community issue, because community unification takes two partners, people that are releasing and the community itself.
There are two programs, too, that I wanted to mention that are great examples of community members coming into the institutions. And the program is called Success Inside and Out. And there's a Success Inside and Out program in Juneau at the Lemon Creek facility, and then one at the women's prison at Highland Mountain in Eagle River. And every year, a large group of, at the Eagle River program, it's primarily women, come in, and they're professionals from the community, and they present all sorts of courses and programming and really trying to make a connection with the women in prison to really let them know that there is a lot of community support for them when they are released. And the same thing happens at the Lemon Creek Institution, but it's more of a co-ed type program. So those kinds of programs are really well received by the public and also by the people who are inside the facilities.
Thank you very
much. Thank you for your time.
I'd like to invite the next community member. Thank you for joining us.
Hello, thank you so much for taking questions. I currently have a close friend of mine that is in the Alaska Corrections system. He's awaiting appeal, and I've gotten the chance to see what his time in there, the effects on him. And I'm curious your perspective of what solitary confinement, administrative segregation, being locked up for 23 hours a day in a really small space, what that does to someone for their release. How does that help them reintegrate into society?
It doesn't.
Yeah,
no. It doesn't. And I can tell you that from our perspective, because we take people immediately upon release. Individuals that have been in solitary confinement for more than 12 months have extraordinary challenges in reentering. Extraordinary challenges, and we never give up on them, but I totally agree that that is something that
Morgan, we need to change in the Department of
Corrections. Right on that.
Department-wide, let's not blame Morgan.
Thank you.
If I may just comment segregation, there are two kinds of segregation that are used by the Department of Corrections. One is administrative, and that is for the inmate's protection. So an inmate can actually ask for administrative segregation because he or she feels that they're not safe in general population, and so they need to be placed away from general population by putting in administrative segregation. It is also used for juvenile offenders who are automatically waived into the adult system, and that would be for 16, 17-year-olds who are charged with the commission of a very serious felony. And it is just as the young woman stated, the very small room, you're inside that room 23 hours a day. It is far, far from being ideal. Then there's punitive segregation, which is a process of segregating inmates that are deemed by the institution to be very dangerous to other inmates, and it's essentially a prison within the prison. And those are the two forms of segregation that are used. The Department of Corrections has been very concerned about the juveniles who are serving time in adult prison, especially pretrial. For that reason, it has a high school that is being operated by the Anchorage School District at the Anchorage Jail. And the goal behind that was to get as many of the juvenile offenders in that high school as possible.
Right. Thank you for the clarifications. Please.
Thank you. My name is Doreen Schenkenberger. I'm Executive Director for Partners for Progress. And thank you very much for putting together this important panel in the series that your station is doing. It's so important to our whole state. I want to bring everyone's attention to another cost savings and recidivism reducing program that is working very well in the state, and that's therapeutic courts. Mm-hmm. Partners for Progress was involved in bringing Anchorage's first therapeutic court, forming it in 1999, and now we have over 10 therapeutic courts statewide. They are a cost savings alternative to incarceration, and they are very successful. So I would just urge support for therapeutic courts, and thank you again.
Thank you very much. I like how at the end of the show we have so many people who would love to contribute. Please.
Hi, my name is Alex. I've struggled most of my life, and I've been in and out of jail, unfortunately. But currently, getting my life back together at a treatment center. And it was pretty easy to get in there. One of the things, though, that I struggle with is you can only call landlines while you're in jail. And most people these days have cell phones. And it's really hard to get a hold of people, and especially when you're trying to, you know, get something done, like get to a treatment center while you're in jail. I know they do have like phone systems you can set up where they got like a money you put on a card, and then mm-hmm. you got your, you know, time on the phone, and it's
so there's some workarounds.
Yeah, there mm-hmm. is in other jails that I've seen, you know, but okay. Up here it's like the Stone Age with the phones, and it's really I don't understand why Securus can't just, you know, be a little bit more lenient on people who are trying to talk to their families and trying to get into treatment centers and trying to get something done. It seems like we're just stuck once we're in there.
So do you feel like that would be an easy way to help with the reentry process is by fixing the phone system?
Yeah.
DOC, are you writing this down?
It would be it would be a big help. Having been there, mm-hmm. trying to get through to people, the expense of calling, you know, and right now I'm having a lot of trouble with my filter because there's things I want to say that may not be constructive. But I think that the true measure of what the Department of Corrections is doing for me is how are they facilitating connection with the family? Because it's proven that connection with the family is the number one indicator of whether or not you're going to succeed. Mm-hmm. And they just instituted having to call or pay for local calls to your family. Mm-hmm. That would, for me, that tells me where DOC's head's at. That tells me that I'm listening to the same old bureaucratic double talk that I've been listening to for 25 years. And that's the filter.
Would you like to add anything else?
No, thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
And we have time for probably one more comment. Please join us.
My name is Jimmy Sweat, and for the last 35 years, I've been involved with Alaska Corrections. Involved in Alaska Corrections for, you know, that long. And in that 35 years, I've seen good and I've seen bad. I've seen people who are doing their job, and I've seen people who are just holding a job. And I think there's, in general, a disconnect. There's two separation of people. There's the people who genuinely care about what happens to people, and then there's others who are just, you know, like I said, holding a job. And one of the things that I found interesting that over the years, because I've heard it many times, is like the operating budget. I remember Carmen said $330 million. She also said that 70% of that goes towards staff. I think that's an issue. That's a problem that should be looked at. Now, I'm not saying that the department shouldn't be staffed up, but when 70% of their budget is on staff rather than programs that help people stay out of jail. You know, I don't know how else to say that. We have to look at that. If I'm running a business and I apologize, I didn't put that together in my head yet, but the point is, there are a lot of things wrong with corrections. And recently, I remember when I first started going to prison, jail from McLaughlin all the way through the state system, all the way to the federal system. I just did 20 years in the federal system. Mm-hmm. I got out 2 years ago, and it's been really rough. And I've been involved in a lot of programs. I am in Venus's MRT. I've been involved with partners. I've been involved with the probation officer. But for some reason, those things aren't enough for some people. Mm-hmm. There's no one size fits all. And the department has to start taking a look at individualized care even after the door. Right now, the policy is I'm going to escort you to the threshold of our property. Then you're on your own. Go see your PO, go see whoever else. And oftentimes, those people don't have real answers or real solutions. They don't have access to programs. They don't have funds and stuff like that.
Thank you so much for your comments. I appreciate it. And thank you all very much for joining us in the studio today. This has been Community and Unity on Alaska Public Media. Community and Unity, a public forum on successful prisoner reentry, was taped on December 3rd at the Alaska Public Media Studios in Anchorage. Special thanks to the Partners Reentry Center for all of their support. You can find out more about prisoner reentry and connect to resources at alaskapublic.org. I'm Urban Affairs reporter Ann Hillman. Thank you for listening.